Welcome to Upahamu Africa, a podcast about life and politics on the African continent. I'm Kimmy Dion, your host, and I'm joined by my co-host, Rachel Beatty-Riedel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Kim, and a big congratulations to us and hello to all our listeners. This is the first episode of season 8. Can you believe it?
I can't. It's been quite a journey.
So much learning, so many amazing guests, and a huge thanks to all of our listeners from around the world.
Now, if you tuned in last week, you heard me say that this was going to be the launching point for season 8, where Rachel and I were going to talk about some of the major events happening on the continent, with a particular focus on the protests in Ghana and the recent coup in Gabon. That was our plan. But, well, we're really lucky because one of our production research assistants, Ami Tamaklo, actually is an expert on the politics and current events of what is happening in Ghana. And she's been witnessing this and following others who are also experiencing the protests in Ghana firsthand. So instead of Rachel and I talking about kind of the political science of protests and how they apply to the current economic and political crisis in Ghana, we're actually going to cut quick to Ami's conversation with three people who have some incredible insight on the protests in Ghana.
Exactly, Kim. I'm so excited for everyone to learn from these experts and social activists. And I'm just going to give really briefly their bios here. Barba Ntumi is a Ghanaian political activist whose work spans across socialism, pan-Africanism, feminism, reproductive justice, and anti-racism. In 2022, she set up the community organization Women's Health Initiative Ghana to address sexual and reproductive health needs of women and girls in Ghana. We'll share her Twitter feed and links for all of our guests in the production notes and our website. And then the second guest, Antoinette Booma, is a private legal practitioner in Accra. So we have a legal expert joining this conversation. And Benjamin Darko is the third guest. He's a 25-year-old Ghanaian student who's really passionate about reforms and constitutional changes. And he's a convener with hashtag Fix the Country, which is a movement that plays a critical role in nonpartisan mobilization towards demanding true change for Ghana. He also doubles as the director for Democracy Hub, which is a sister organization of Fix the Country, and it provides legal support for activists in Ghana. And this really is just all coming out of his commitment towards building true change within Ghana's political landscape.
Yes, also included in those links that Rachel mentioned were different ways to support people who are participating in the protests, if our listeners feel so moved. And again, we're really grateful to Ami Tamaklo for convening this conversation at, in the moment as things are still unfolding in Ghana. We can also suggest that our listeners refer back to earlier episodes we've had with political scientists who study protests and social movements on the continent. For example, Lisa Mueller, when we talked to her many seasons ago now about her book on protest in contemporary Africa. And she talks a lot about class and about economic grievances. And I think that that's a great book to read, but also a great conversation to listen to. Likewise, we've had conversations with Zachariah Mompilli, who co-authored the book with Adam Branch, Africa Uprising. And so, reach back into our catalog to have a listen to those episodes, take a look at those books to provide some additional context to this really energetic conversation that that Ami has convened for our listeners. One other note we have for those of you who applied to our non-resident fellow program, we thank you so much for your patience. We did receive nearly 1,000 applications, so our process has taken a bit longer than we had expected it would in making decisions, but we hope to have decisions out to our applicants in the coming week or two. And we look forward in season 8 to introducing our listeners to who our new non-resident fellows will be.
Absolutely. Kim, we have such an amazing applicant pool. So thanks to everyone who applied and thanks to those who shared the word and the call. So now take a listen to Ami Amita Makloe and her guests. Thank you so much.
Thank you all and welcome to the Ufahamu podcast. This podcast is dedicated to issues around politics in Africa. And this particular topic is very important because it's close to home. My name is Amita Maklo. I am an anthropological artist working with the team, the Ufahamu Africa team. I'm currently at Cornell University. And this topic, again, is close to home because I am from Ghana. But before we start, I'm going to read your bios to introduce all of you here. And if there's anything you'd like to add to it, please feel free to do so. So we'll start with Antoinette Bwama. Antoinette Bwama is a private legal practitioner in Accra. Hi, Antoinette.
Hi.
And then Barbara Ntumi. Barbara Ntumi is a Ghanaian political activist whose work spans across socialism, pan-Africanism, feminism, reproductive justice, and anti-racism. In 2002, she set up the community organization Women's Health Initiative Ghana to address the sexual and reproductive health needs of women and girls in Ghana. Welcome, Barbara. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Wonderful. Thank you for being here. And last but definitely not the least, Benjamin Darko. Benjamin Darko is a 25-year-old Ghanaian student who is passionate about reforms and constitutional changes. He's a convener with the hashtag Fix the Country, a movement that plays a critical in nonpartisan mobilization towards demanding for true change for Ghana. He also doubles as the director for Democracy Hub, a sister organization of Fix the Country that provides legal support for activists in Ghana. This cements his commitment towards building true change within Ghana's political landscape. Benjamin, with the help of Democracy Hub and Ghanaians, organized a three-day protest dubbed hashtag Occupy Julobi House, which is the reason why we are here. Welcome, Benjamin.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you all for being here. So let's start with just, again, housekeeping. How is Ghana?
Ghana is very expensive and hot.
Expensive?
Ghana is basically retrogressing at a faster rate. We don't have a clear plan out now. And it's our fervent hope that citizens' uprisings will lead to a better change for the state because it doesn't really look clean and clear right now for us as a country.
Barbara, you want to add anything?
I don't disagree with anything that has been said, but I guess maybe I'm more hopeful than pessimistic. I think Ghana is on the cusp of something hopefully revolutionary, and I'm looking forward to where it will go. And I know that if it succeeds, it will benefit a lot of people, not just in Ghana, but as well globally. So I'm choosing the more optimistic route.
That is very necessary. So my first question is, what is the rationale behind the protest, the recent Occupy Jollibee protest, which happened for 3 days in Ghana? And I hear this weekend it was also happening in New York City. I'll give this question to Benjamin since you are part of the organizers for this.
So thanks, Ami. I think within the context of protesting in Ghana here, it's quite important that to recognize that these demonstrations basically are rooted in genuine concerns from basically Ghanaians now. It also highlights the fact that Ghanaians are coming together for not the first time, but on this time around in a very clear, non-partisan way to demand for true changes. These are demonstrations that collectively highlight some of the issues that plague our country, from governance issues, comes to issues surrounding corruption, the fact that we have a lack of transparency, especially from our authorities within the state, and it also highlights the socioeconomic challenges that we as a country are facing. One of the key things that we were discussing prior to the demonstration was the state of the Tema motorway, which serves as a route for huge economic activities within the country. So that was the rationale behind the protest itself.
Thank you, Benjamin. What do you think, or what do you hope the protest achieved? Like, what were the hopes for protesting? Why would people go out on the street for 3 days? It started on a Thursday and it ended on Saturday.
Why did people go out? What did they hope to achieve?
So for us basically, what we hope that this protest will achieve is that it serves as a more powerful catalyst for true change for our country. We basically want to say that we're using this kind of platform to sort of highlight the pressing issues that we as a country are facing. And ultimately, we hope that it will lead to more meaningful and true reforms that would shape our democracy for the best. Currently, when you come to Ghana here, we have a system where I doubt the manifesto run country because we move 4 years to 4 years listening to parties telling us what they're going to do for our country. We don't have a true plan or a very clear directive on where we are heading as a country. So that is what we aim to achieve with this kind of tools that we are using or activating as citizens within a country.
Yeah, I think Benjamin is being too general with his reforms, with his input on what he hopes to achieve. Personally, I just want things to get better. That's all I want these protests to achieve. I want the cost of living to come a little lower for us, the youth. Because, I mean, this protest was more of the youth protesting than the older generation. And I think what we hope it achieves is for us to know that, like, there is a better future for us. We are not working in vain. Because at the moment, it looks like we are working in vain. Because whatever you make, you spend everything on expenses these days. That's what mostly influences most of the youth to step out. So personally, what I hope this protest achieves is a lower cost of living for us and better systems in place for us, the youth. Yes.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything either of you have said. I don't disagree with anything you've said, but then I'm going to disagree a little with you, Benjamin, because you said that the country is not moving in the right direction. And my disagreement will become clear very soon. It actually is. It's moving in the correct direction for a few people, right? Where we are right now, it's not by coincidence. It's by design. We have a two-party state in Ghana, which I've heard that behind closed doors, they're very, very good friends, all of them. So they're a political class of their own. So I would actually argue that we're moving in the right direction for them, but not for the majority of Ghanaians. And I know that that's what the protest was attempting to clarify, right? Because Ghana, a lot of people are tied by, you know, social, ethnic, and religious beliefs. Like, that's how a lot of people go through their life. Some people would think that, oh, the reason why Ghana is in the state that it is that, you know, quote, and we're not religious enough. That might be some people's conclusion to the current state we're in. But you and I and all of us in this podcast know that that's categorically not true. But that is their orientation towards the situation. So I guess what the protest was doing in many ways, I think, from my perspective, was clarifying things to people. And I think the way that the police particularly behaved on the first day was actually a clarifying moment for a lot of people, right? Because I had people say stuff like, oh, but we're also fighting for the police. The police are part of us. And for me, it was important for me to make the distinction. Actually, no, we're not. The police are not part of us. They are being used for a specific purpose. That is continue to protect the class, the people who are aligned politically with the people, the two parties that have ruled our country since independence, since, you know, Rawlings's coup. So that's my disagreement with you, Benjamin. And you find that we're not so very much different. I'm sure you'd agree with what I've just said. So I think the protest served as a clarifying moment for people. I think that a lot of people in Ghana don't know that they have the right to protest a lot of the unlawful, right? The unlawful and terrible management of our country. So the police behavior on the first day of the protest and the way that people on, you know, mostly social media and in Ghana, you know, rallied to get support, to get lawyers, to make sure that people were taken care of and eventually released, I think was a clarifying moment for a lot of people. Well, at least I hope it was, to know that actually we collectively Ghanaians, not the people affiliated to political parties or MPs or ministers that run things. Actually, when we take all of them out of the equation and we think about the rest of us, actually, we are each other's keeper. We are there for each other. I think that shifted a lot of people's perspective on the current situation that Ghana is, which, you know, as Antoinette said earlier, is economic, right? I think economic is where a lot of people are feeling it, not so much in the broader political space, but I think economic is where a lot of people are feeling it. So, you know, the protest so cleverly named Julobi House, which is, you know, a thief's child. Julobi means, you know, a thief's child in Ga's house. And, you know, a play on Jubilee House, which is where the president lives and works from. And, you know, Benjamin could correct me if I'm wrong, but that's where the protest was advertised to be initiated, right? That's initially where a lot of people were subsequently arrested. And we know for the other days of the protest, the police had a cordon. So they had people further down, you know, about 10, 15 minute walk, if you're walking really fast, 10, to Jubilee House, down outside, further down from where the president lives and works. So yeah, that's my assessment of the protests.
Thank you all for that insight. So the next question is, of all the ways that the people of Ghana could have exerted their constitutional rights, why a protest? Why a protest? Benjamin, why a protest?
So we went the route of a protest because basically we've exhausted all the other options we have, a democracy have. We've activated the tools that we have in terms of going to courts. During the e-levy passage process, I think I went to the Supreme Court to have the whole process stalled, that it is going to end up in double taxation of citizens, but the courts ruled against me.
For listeners who may not know what e-levy is, could you expand on what e-levy is?
So e-levy is an electronic transaction levy that is placed on any kind of transactions that you pay for using the mobile money or e-cash in Ghana here. It attracts a fee of 1% on any amount that you send cross networks in Ghana here. It's a tax that received a lot of backlash from the Ghanaian citizenry. So we had to go to court to get the whole process stalled, but the Supreme Court ruled against us that we do not have the power to stop what is happening in Parliament. So it was passed. We've also used the same courts, the judiciary, sort of like getting the EI for the, I think that would be the Restrictions Movement Act, the executive instrument that was passed by Parliament and was used by the president during the COVID period. We had to go to the Supreme Court to get it cancelled, that it's an infringement on the rights of Ghanaians.
What is that? The EI?
The EI was what gave the president the power to say, you can't move from your house, you can't go to work, you need to stay at home during the time of the COVID. Now, what Parliament did was that instead of giving limits to when that power was going to last, they made it in perpetuity. So it was something that could go beyond COVID. So we had to go to the courts to get the court to revoke that particular EI. So it's not like we always go for protest and all that, but there's a huge significance about protesting in Ghanaian history. You look from the NIAs during pre-independence era, it was the same tools that Nkrumah used. It was the same thing that our current president, Nanado, used against the then Rawlings administration when VAT was passed by the Rawlings administration. So protesting is a very key tool in trying to bring civilians to be part of the democratic process. So normally, if we have something that we are agitating for and we want to call on Ghanaians to add their voices, the main thinking is that we should go the way of protesting or picketing, which was what led us to pick this kind of tool in trying to bring Ghanaians out to talk about not just socioeconomic issues, but a very key thing that we've been highlighting is the fact that we have a constitution that basically makes it very difficult to demand for accountability, makes it difficult for leaders to be more transparent. And if you go down below and you look at all the issues we have, at the head of everything is the constitution itself. That is where the biggest issue comes from. So that is why we went the way of a protest. It offers an avenue for Ghanaians to express their grievances and frustrations with the particular system and the style of governance that we have. And also it provides a more unique platform for ordinary people out there to also push for positive change within their own country.
Thank you for that, Benjamin. A few things were mentioned, like how I asked you to talk about the e-levy and mobile money and the EI bill. Honestly, the EI, I didn't even know about that. So for listeners, mobile money in many parts of the continent of Africa, let's speak for Ghana, because that's what we're talking, where we're talking about now. Mobile money is a form of financial transaction that usually happens from your phone, and it's not through an app, even though service providers could have an app. Usually it's linked to your network provider, so you can transfer money to and from your personal wallet to friends, family, pay bills. And so the e-levy was essentially a bill to tax people's personal finances. So essentially the government was putting its hands in the pockets of Ghanaian citizens. Now, do you guys remember how the e-levy bill actually got passed? Wasn't it when Ghana had a soccer match or something?
Exactly.
There was a game.
Exactly.
There was a football match going on, and while everyone was busy watching football, they went into parliament and passed the bill while the general public opposed it. So just to give context around some of these things. So when we're talking about constitutional change, which is something that Benjamin mentioned, I was hoping to get some examples of things that are in our current constitution, which seem to impede the growth or possibility of growth for Ghana at this point. You mentioned the constitution gives the president a demagogue-esque kind of positioning. And it would be nice for listeners to know some of these things in the constitution that are facilitating that.
Okay, so let me just cite some few examples. When you come to Ghana, I'll use a current issue that is actually trending on Twitter. There was a situation that happened at UTV yesterday evening, where TAX went to the studio and basically tried to push their way through and disrupt a TV program. They issued some threats to A+, a certain political figure in Ghana here. And when it happened, there were police officers in there, but as soon as the guy said they were from the ruling party, the cops left the scene. One of the biggest issues we have in Ghana is that we basically leave all appointing powers to the president. So you look at some of our key institutions like the army, the police, you go all the way to Shraj, Yoko, and all of these key state institutions, and all their bosses are appointed by the president. Some of the key functioning institutions that we had then was Shraj, basically playing the role of an ombudsman within Ghana here. But then they had their powers curtailed by parliament. In a move that says Shraj cannot kickstart cases unless someone reports to them.
What is Shraj again, for those who don't know what Shraj is?
Shraj plays the role of an ombudsman, so like a watchkeeper or someone who oversees stuff, and initially had the powers to prosecute people on its own if it deemed so, and start cases against individuals. But then our parliament stepped in and then curtailed some of the powers that they had. So apart from the appointing powers and all that, see, you have the issue where, apart from a private member's bill and stuff, the only figure within the Ghanaian state that can initiate bills is a president. We do not have something that Kenya has, which is a popular initiative bill. We don't have something of that sort in Ghana here. So if civilians want to see true change, either they koto to a member of parliament to kickstart the process for them. They can't do those things on their own. These are some of the things we've been painting that it doesn't really help our democracy grow. And the fact that you have someone that everyone is trying to please, which is the president, it makes it very difficult for these key institutions to work independently and to have strong constitutional backing to actually achieve or do their work properly.
Thank you so much, Benjamin. You've talked a lot about the constitution. There are things that I don't know the Ghanaian constitution cover to cover, but the little that I've read, I raised an eyebrow on certain parts of it. And I wanted to ask, Barbara and Antoinette, might you be familiar with aspects of the constitution that you find problematic and think could use some reform?
Yeah, I have quite a lot to add to that, actually. So I think this is more so, for me personally, an issue of kind of tacked in and long-term organizing and strategy. Now, I really do commend the work of GA's Fix the Country and Democracy Hub. I think that their campaign and their raising of this issue of the constitution is incredibly important. I think it's good work. But for me personally, I think I'm afraid that the thinking is that if we fix the constitution, we'll kind of fix everything. I also think that the constitution as an entry point for people to understand politically what is happening in Ghana is inaccessible. It's completely inaccessible. It requires you to have a certain grasp of things that a lot of Ghanaians just don't have. And this is honestly not me putting people down, but I think we have to be realistic about where we are, where people are at, and take them on a journey to that conclusion. Will a reform of the constitution, a one that is centered around, you know, some of the things that Benjamin has talked about, or some of the things that, you know, even people of protest has talked about, would that be great? Of course it would be. It would be brilliant. It would be fantastic. However, I just don't think that that is where we're at. I think that we are a much, 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 much further down the line than that. We are a position where people are acting against their own self-interest in the name of the ruling class. And that is what we need to clarify to people. We need to make them see clearly that there's an us and versus them. There really is. And if we don't do that, going on about the constitution and saying that we need reform, sadly, it's going to go over a lot of people's heads, but it's very easy for other forces to also hijack this particular mechanism. But if you build a sort of consciousness that is about all of us, we're talking about what kind of Ghana do we want to see? So we're saying to people, you know, okay, you want good schools. You want your children to leave school and have opportunities. You want good roads. You want running electricity. You want water. You want jobs that bring you dignity. You want to be able to go to work and look after your family and plan and dream. We have to explain to people that it is right now impossible because of the people that rule and lead us and all the people that align to them. We have to make that very clear to people. If we don't, it will just be another thing that another entity can hijack, right? I'm sure that a lot of what is happening, a lot of the abuse of power that's happening within the constitution, it wasn't built for it to happen that way, but people have used it because ultimately the constitution is a tool. Anybody can use it and however they see fit. This idea that, oh, we don't have things in place to stop people. No, the government goes against the law. They break the law all the time. They know a lot of what they're doing is unlawful. But again, they have friends on the judiciary that are going to cover their back. They're also aligned to people in political power. So they don't care. At the end of the day, they are running this country as they see it fit. And that works for them. It's what I said earlier, is that, you know, we're not down this path because the country is going in the wrong path. No, it is by design. It's just that there is not a lot of them. And there is way more of us, and people are slowly realizing that the scales are not tipped in their favor. People are slowly realizing that actually things aren't working for them, and they're trying to find their voice and speak up. And this is another thing that we don't talk about in Ghana. Even in our interpersonal relationship, it's frowned upon for people to speak up. It's frowned upon for you to stand up and say, you know what? This thing that is happening right here is wrong. Or this thing that is going on here is wrong. I see it. It's happening in my own personal family, you know? So I think that's another piece of work that we have to do. We have to make people understand that there is honor in standing up and calling something for what it is and saying, you know what, this is wrong. And we shouldn't do this way. And this is the truth. Because there's only one truth, right? There's no multiple versions of the truth. There's only one. And a lot of people are afraid to stand up. How many people do we know that live in Ghana that are aligned to people with political parties that know what they're doing, but feel that they can't say anything? They don't have the power to say anything, or nobody will stand behind them. So whilst I really do commend the efforts of Democracy Hub and GH Fix the Country, and I'm honestly not opposed. I just don't think that we are where we are, where we can mobilize the mass of Ghanaians behind a constitutional change. I think we're further down the line. We need to answer how now people are going to feed, eat, clothe themselves, and figure out their lives. And once we do that collectively among all of us, then we can talk about constitutional change, because we will have a whole group of people that want to build a different kind of a country. That means that whatever constitution that we make, hopefully people will abide by it, because we've all gone through a process together, at least the majority of us. I don't think that everybody will want to join us, but the majority of us have gone through a political process together, and we understand what the stakes are. So that's what I personally think.
Thank you so much, Barbara. So the next question, let's talk about the protest. And this is very dear to my heart because I was losing my mind knowing that there wasn't much I could do in person. But let's talk about the 3-day protest. What happened? What happened from Thursday to Saturday? What happened?
Okay, so I can only address day one and day three because day two I was locked up in some meetings with authorities. So day one, Thursday 21st, I left home, went towards the protest grounds at 37. We were about 56, around 7:30 a.m. And then the police came in with the bus and they abducted us, basically. That wasn't an arrest because we weren't told why we were being taken away. They just whisked us into a bus and then drove us to regional command, so central station. When we got there, they instructed us or forcefully told us to sit on the floor, and they seized our phones, mobile phones, and any gadgets that we had on us. Even went as far as taking medicines and people's identity cards and stuff. Then they pushed us into an office and then they assaulted us. That was day one. After the assault and everything, they split us into, I think, if my memory says right, about 8 groups of 7 protesters each, and sent us to various stations across Accra. I was at Central Police Station, quite close to regional commands. We were forced to take off our shirts, and basically they told us to go naked and pushed us into a cell without telling us what we've done wrong. We stayed there till I think the police let go of me around 8:50 p.m. That was around 9 p.m. So obviously Antoinette and Co were working in the background during that time, but that was when the police let go of us. And we had to join our other colleagues and then take a walk through town. And we had some planning towards what would happen on day two. Day two, I went to the protest grounds. I left there around 11 a.m. We still went back to 37 to sort of like gather momentum. Around 11 a.m., I had a meeting with the chief of police who was actually pleading with us to call off the protest. But then I had to remind him that on the side of the law, what we are doing was legal, and we fulfilled everything to the tune of the law. So the police do not have any rights to say we should end the protest. I go back to grounds around 7:30 p.m. when most of the activities have already taken place. The singing and the jama going on during the rain and all that. I missed everything. We closed day two around 9 p.m. And then on day three, I went back to Central Commands to get my devices or personal effects. I was denied. I got them on Tuesday. So I stayed with the police for about 6 days or 5 days or so without me getting access to my mobile phones and devices that I took with me to the protest. I think Saturday was when most of the things happened. I'm not really someone who is seen doing protests and all that. I tend to stay behind and look at the organization and discussions with police and what they can do and what they can't do during protests, because I don't want any police officer or any protester to go out of line and then mar what we are doing, or maybe try to step on the toes of the police and get them to react. So I try to stay in the background and speak with the police bosses and stuff. I think there were some periods where we had discussions on the constitution, some of the challenges plaguing our country, the economic woes and stuff. We invited some social media influencers, or so they are called, to come and give some speeches and talk about some of the issues that we are facing as a country. So I agree with Barbara that for this protest itself, we organized around economic issues. But then when it comes to the constitution and stuff, these are long-term things that Fix the Country has been pursuing. We've written to parliament and stuff to kickstart that process. So even though we try to draw in civilians, we do not use that as a means to amass crowds, because we know very well that it's not everyone that knows what is wrong with our constitution and what needs to change and what doesn't need to change. So basically that was what happened within the whole 3 days.
Thank you very much, Antoinette. Now legal team, president of legal affairs. You are trending on Twitter, superstar.
the day before the protest, we saw that the police had released a statement. And in the statement, they said they had applied for an injunction. So once they had applied for the injunction, the protest could not come on. So they had to cancel the protest. Then in the evening, I saw that some of the Fix the Country guys had tweeted that they hadn't received any injunction. They had not been served with any injunction. So the protest was still going to happen the next day. So when those conversations started, I assumed they had contacted some lawyers because they have lawyers. Benjamin, you have lawyers, right? They have lawyers. So I assumed everything was in place. So I wasn't worried. So people kept reaching out to me, asking me if they should go for the protest or not. And I told them that from the way things are looking, if you go, something might happen. Just be ready to face what might happen. If you want to be part of the heroes, I think you should go because there's certainly going to be some arrests. So those who decided to go went, and those who didn't want to go to stayed back. So when I got there, other lawyers were there. Some three or four lawyers were there. What I did was I asked them to get the names of those who had been arrested. So if you knew the names of anyone, you just mention it. And we decided to let it go to social media. So I was tweeting by the minute. Everything that was happening, I was just tweeting about it and asking people to continue making noise, use the hashtag, tag foreign media, tag politicians, tag everyone, just continue making noise about it. So we were there, we were calling for more lawyers to come. So at that day, we had almost 30 lawyers volunteer. So immediately we formed a group and we started sending out information to them. So we divided ourselves. Before we divided ourselves, we met the commander and we spoke to the commander. They had a meeting with us and they told us that their order was that they should let us name specific people we were representing. But the senior lawyers amongst us said no. We were representing everyone who had been arrested in connection with the protest that day. We divided ourselves and we spread across the stations to help them write their statement. And we told Olele, the journalists who were outside, we told them to let more protesters come around. So they were outside the station. We're outside the station, just standing there, causing a bit of traffic and all that. So it was a lot of pressure on the police. At that point, we had all lost hope. Me, I had lost hope. I won't lie. I had lost hope. So we agreed that we would get more lawyers so that the next day, if they took them to court, if they processed them for court the next day, we'd get people to apply for bail for all of them. And they could be taking them to different courts that we didn't know about. So we wanted lawyers everywhere. So if we could get lawyers in Tema, if we could get lawyers in Wager, if we could get lawyers in Dansuman, if we could get lawyers in Kasua, more than 50 lawyers joining the group. So we were ready for the next day.
It was a lot of work on the legal team, but listen to how you guys were able to find 50 lawyers just on the jump.
Yes. I mean, that day we had 30 lawyers, like 30 lawyers. But after that day, that's when we had more lawyers joining because we wanted more lawyers to join in case that the situation repeated itself the subsequent days, which it didn't. So that day, I reached my DM limit that day because people were just sending me lists of people they couldn't reach. And I was sending the list to all the lawyers who had been deployed to various stations. That's how we're working the whole time. So I was driving back to Kokrobite. So around 6, I saw a message that they said the commander has come back, that another order has come and he wants to admit everyone to bail. They needed 10 sureties. So I immediately tweeted and I tagged Olele that if they are around, they should rush to the regional headquarters. They needed 10 sureties for the bail. That's what happened on the first day. So I think by 8:39, everyone had been released. And to date, they've not brought any charges against anyone. So we don't know exactly why they had them arrested. Well, That's what happened on the first day. The second day, I wasn't around. But on the third day, I went. I was there till like 6 p.m. Nothing bad was happening. Everything was organized and all that. So
thank you for being the liaison and working Twitter to the advantage of the people.
It was interesting to hear Antoinette recount what happened and what was basically behind the scenes. Some of my friends did get arrested. So thank you personally very much for getting everybody out. But the reason why I wanted to come in is because I wanted to express how institutionally this shouldn't have happened. So Antoinette finished by saying that till to date, so it's been couple of weeks now since the protest, none of the people that were arrested, held for over 12 hours, had, from what you can tell me, many of their personal, you know, individual rights, human rights violated for attending a protest, have been charged with anything. And how is it possible that, you know, in a law in a country that exists as ours, where the laws are clear on a lot of things, that, you know, protesters, people who were firstly, you know, expressing their constitutional right to protest. Number two, so the BBC still to date has a news article up that says that protesters defied a ban. The story that ran around, you know, there was other places I saw that did not report that. So more left-leaning platforms didn't report that because they saw, you know, lots of us tweet saying there actually was no legal basis for A, stopping the protest, but also arresting people for showing up to a protest. Then you as a police force saying that it's been banned doesn't mean that it's been banned, because it actually in law was not banned. So here is another example where we have laws, we have systems, people willing to defy them for political reasons. And again, this is an example of clarifying things for Ghanaians. People were saying, oh, the police are among us, the police are the citizens. No, the police belong to a class of their own. They're instruments used by people in political power. They're there to protect the property of the rich and the powerful, and not to protect us. Lots of people have police stories online of being stopped, of being searched, of having things planted on them. We know as a fact that the police abuse their power in Ghana. In many ways, the police is up for hire. And again, I think that this particular incident is another gift, for lack of a better word, that we've been given as an opportunity to clarify things for people, to say, hey, yes, you know, the police are quote unquote members of our society, but they perform a very specific function, which is to oppress us. What are we as a community going to do about that? What are we, when we think about our future, how do we want to keep each other safe? How do we want to make sure that the rule of law is respected? I think it's another opportunity to also have these conversations with people.
Yes, thank you so much for that. And thank you for recounting what happened over the three-day protest and how legal aid came in. So while there were some unfortunate things that happened, i.e. the arrests and the assaults, what are some things you are all proud of about the protest? What are some things that made you proud about the protest?
How we were able to gather and mobilize on the spot. I'm very proud of my lawyers. And there were 80% of them are junior lawyers, young lawyers at the bar, not senior lawyers. We had just about 5 lawyers who were senior lawyers, established lawyers. The rest were just young lawyers. So I think there's hope for the future. I'm very proud of my lawyers. I'll not stop saying it.
I'm proud of you, Antoinette and Benjamin and everybody for putting, because it's not easy in Ghana to speak truth to power, for putting yourselves physically and your careers on the line to stand up for what is right and for what is just. So I'm proud of you guys. But yeah, I'm proud of, you know, I'm going to keep it really honest, right? I didn't think that people would come out, honestly, and not because I don't think that people don't know, people don't understand. And I hope Antoinette and Benjamin can testify to this. Despite my very British accent, I am Ghanaian. I grew up in Ghana. You know, I have family in Ghana. I'm in Ghana a lot. I spend a lot of time in Ghana. And, you know, we socially have a society where, like I said earlier, it's frowned upon to like kind of stand up and speak out, right? To stick out. It's frowned upon. Like you should be quiet and, you know, be part of the crowd. And, you know, if you don't want to cause antagonism, so you don't want to make people uncomfortable. So I guess I'm really proud of all the people that, you know, showed up despite all the forces and all the things, you know, people showed up to the protest of the day to make their voice heard. whether it was on social media or otherwise. But another thing I'm incredibly proud of was the community of, you know, kind of queer left-leaning activists on Twitter who organized throughout the entire 3 days of the protest to raise money, to feed people that were locked up, to help coordinators. And I'm sure Antoinette can back me up, to help coordinate some of the lawyers to get to these places and make sure that people got out, to make sure that people got home safe, right? I'm really proud of that kind of work. And in the days after the initial day of the protest, a lot of what these people did as well was to translate some of the ask and the demands in different Ghanaian languages. And we were tweeting 24/7 and we were talking and we're encouraging people to make TikToks, encouraging people to make videos, we're encouraging people to like send voice notes, we're encouraging people outside of social media to talk to their friends and family. You know, we're encouraging people to go and talk to your parents, because the other thing we don't talk about, and Antoinette, you pointed it out quite clearly in the kind of the age difference or the caliber of people you ended up working with, is that a lot of young people on some level are engaged with this issue. A lot of older people, they kind of know. But I think there's something about a lot of these older people coming from an era in Ghana where you couldn't speak out, right? That's the other thing we forget. There was repression in Ghana for a considerable amount of time, and that has stayed with people. You know, you had a lot of older people being like, oh, yes, this is not a thing that we really could have done in my time, right? And that speaks to the kind of political climate that existed then, which in some ways they still feel like exists now, because a lot of people were shocked that people went out to protest, to stand up and to speak out, and a protest that wasn't affiliated with any political party. Because Benjamin talked earlier about Ghana's history of protest, right? And it's an incredibly important one. However, it's been forgotten. Like, people don't know that, or people don't come from an area where that exists anymore, right? We've been sold this democracy. We've been sold that the only way people can voice their concern is to vote. But how much is your vote really worth if the two political parties in the country are just the other side of the same coin? Like, what options do we really have? So this was a good opportunity for people to, you know, be clarified on those politics and those things, and to go on and have those conversations with other people. And so, yeah, I'm proud for everyone who showed up. I'm proud for all the Ghanaians who supported. I'm proud for all the Ghanaians who, you know, didn't understand, but took a moment to listen, to try to understand, because that's the thing. There's so many people we have to bring on board. So yeah, I'm proud of everyone, basically, except the police and the people that give the order. I'm not proud of them. Not proud of them. Shame on them.
Benjamin, is there anything you're proud of?
For me, I think I'm proud about the organization of the protest itself. And I agree with Barbara. This is the first time that we've actually brought lots of communities within Ghana to join in organizing a protest.
So now that the protest is done, what's next?
The work continues. We still continue with our advocacy efforts. It doesn't stop yet. And I think right after the protest, we kickstarted something on Twitter again with the wider community that we're liaising with, which was Know Your Failed Leaders. I think you might have seen some pictures and stuff on Twitter discussing these issues, where we highlight our leaders and talk about some of their shortcomings during this administration and some of the issues plaguing our country. And it's not something that is selective on just those from the ruling party, but it cuts across both parties. So these are Ghanaians addressing their leaders and trying to give them a scorecard based on how they've performed so far. We've had some debriefing sessions on how to take this thing off social media and get them to the local community and the market spaces and stuff. So we're running these activities afterwards in anticipation for another protest that will happen in December. We still not decided on the date yet. We still jaw-jaw, and I think maybe by close of day tomorrow, we should have a date outside for people to know what is going to happen next. I think apart from that, we've also put it across that we want to meet with policymakers within our country to sort of like know how to structure things properly, because we don't want to keep everything to just rants and vents online and all that. So whilst you are protesting, you also kickstart the process where you engage the policymakers, and those are effect change within our country to kickstart some of the processes. So we've written to Parliament about wanting to meet both sides of the divide and have a meeting with them or sit down with them. We've gone as far as trying to know what we can do to demand concrete action on some of the issues that we've raised. So we've thought about writing to the Ministry of Roads and Highways about the condition of the Tema Motorway, issues around in some highlighted places within the country where we do not have functioning street lights and all that, and traffic control lights are not operating. So these are some of the things that we're trying to do at Fix the Country after this protest. But a very key part is fixed on the fact that we want to take this conversation not off social media, but to the local community out there, to get the market women and our mothers out there to also be part of the conversation. And hopefully it will have an impact on the next election. And our biggest goal is to have a Ghana where people will not exchange their votes for a party t-shirt or for 20 cities before they cast their ballots.
Thank you for that. What's next, Barbara?
Socialism. It's the only way. I'm a socialist. We have to build a movement for people to be a part of, for people to have a stake in this country. We can't be ruled by the few. It doesn't work, and it's not going to work. And socialism is ruled by the working people, the people that make the wealth, the people that create the GDP for, you know, the president or the government to be able to go externally and borrow money, right? That those people, they are the ones that needs to run Ghana. And, you know, I see my role as a socialist, as a political activist, is to help and guide the transfer of power from the elite, the political class, into the hands of working people. And the working people will determine what system they want to have, how they want to rough stuff, the distribution of resources, et cetera. And it's been done in many parts of the world. So it is possible. I don't believe for one second that it's not possible. I might not see in my lifetime, but it is possible. It is the best way to get people everything that they need to have in order to live, you know, accomplished, fulfilling lives. Right now, all our resources are concentrated in the hands of a few. And this is not just Ghana. I mean, Ghana is part of an entire world. We live in a global capitalist system. And there has to be that transfer of power, because we cannot rely on a few people to continue to govern and rule us, because it's not working. People are suffering. There's enough resources in the world to end poverty and hunger. And that's not happening. And we have to genuinely ask ourselves why. And I only think the way we can do that is through socialism. Working people have to seize the means of production and distribute those resources evenly and build a state in which everybody lives a dignified life. That's what I think.
Thank you, Barbara. Antoinette, what's next?
As Benjamin said, the work continues. So I recently joined some of their pages, see how far the planning of the December protests are going. And we still have our legal team on standby. So I don't know. Maybe we'll liaise with them and then we'll know how we can help the team. Basically that we just want better governance. In the meantime, that's what we want. So till we see it, we'll continue with the protests. Yeah.
Thank you. So we've talked about the economic being the straw that pretty much broke the camel's back. Now, some people may not know what's been happening in Ghana, and it would be nice for them to hear some examples of the things. A personal one for me, which is very, very personal, is who needs a national cathedral? Who needs a national cathedral when the road network between the south and the north is in just despicable state? Meanwhile, Parliament is pushing to build. How much is the National Cathedral again?
In the hundreds of millions of dollars.
A ridiculous amount of money, taxpayers' money. We've talked about, or I've heard on Twitter, someone vent because people are literally giving birth in hallways. People are dying in hospital chairs. The national health insurance scheme that was supposed to alleviate pressures for the average Ghanaian who needs to get basic healthcare is not functioning. Any more examples you guys have just to give people context of what's happening? Let's not even talk about the city to dollar ratio right now. And was it 2 years ago when it almost reached a dollar to 20 cities?
It was last year.
Last year.
It was last year. Yeah, December, wasn't it? I remember just looking at it in disbelief. I was like, what is happening? It was, yeah, it was, but I mean, okay, so Ghana's economic situation is probably on the same-ish adjacent trajectory to a lot of countries of our size post, you know, the COVID era. But that's not the only reason why. The government would like to explains everything away with COVID and the Russian-Ukraine war, which, of course, did have some effect, absolutely. But the biggest effect was basically the government's borrowing. Like this government, the government prior to this one as well. So it's not just a quote-unquote MPP issue. The issue started about 10 years ago, is that we were borrowing at an alarmingly high rate with really high interest rates. And instead of paying off loans, we were borrowing from other to pay off. And that saw the massive increase of inflation. You know, when I was in Ghana last year, you'd go down to the shop to buy, you know, Don Simon, and it was one price. And 2 days later, you go and it was like three times the price you bought it 2 days before. It was nothing I've ever experienced in my life before. And we had the BBC reporting recently that, you know, the central bank lost $5 billion. You know, basically when we were on our knees and there was an economic crisis, and I think the central bank's role is to be like, okay, what are we going to do? Instead, they just printed more money and gave it to the government, which is why we're in the situation that we're in. And it's real life impact and consequences is that, yeah, nothing, no system, no area of Ghana is functioning the way that it was supposed to. You were talking about health. I'm sure, Antoinette and Benjamin, you've seen, we had a recent issue about the dialysis, right? The hospital announced that they were increasing, you know, dialysis treatment, amount that people would pay. And, you know, rightly so, we were all up on Twitter in uproar. We were trying to find, you know, why is this? What is the cause? Again, this is something that I think a lot of people assumed should be provided and covered for the most part by the National Insurance Service scheme, right? And then the hospital comes out and say, oh, no, it was a mistake. Somebody leaked it. Bearing in mind, the reason we all found out is because it was posted outside the unit. Like, nobody leaked it. It was a poster that was put up, right? So they like to insult our intelligence. Oh, somebody leaked it. We're going to investigate. Then the health minister comes and says, no, it's wrong. And then the CEO is like, yeah, no, but nobody is, you know, we're going to reverse that and nobody's been charged. And then we see people post receipts online having been charged this new inflated price. And so nothing in Ghana works the way that it's supposed to. And I hate to say, a lot of people are complicit in it. Like, people take our actions and do things without asking questions because, you know, people hold power and they can affect your lives in many ways. So I don't know where I was going with this. I'm going to stop there. Somebody should come in.
Okay. It's okay. So what I'd asked was for some cases to give people context of what's happening in Ghana. So I gave some examples, National Cathedral, the diversion from actual problems by putting this private members bill in parliament just to confuse people and just draw the attention away from actual problems by going after the queer community, stuff like this. Anything else you want to add?
Taxes, luxury taxes on sanitary pads, taxes everywhere, taxes, like fuel prices. Fuel is so high right now. At the moment, it's around 13 cedis or 14 cedis per liter. Yeah. And electricity. We can't even pay for electricity. Now, when you turn on your AC, you turn it on for maybe 30 minutes and you turn it off because you can't pay for electricity. We are paying more than twice the amount you used to pay at this time last year.
So my biggest challenge is that I tend to lump everything together. I can't break issues down, but I know we have some key issues in Ghana here. For us, it was the fact that we couldn't demand for accountability. You look at the Cecily Adapa case where she stashed over $1 million at home. That was one of the issues. We have poor roads and bad hospitals.
So now that we finished the 3-day protest on the ground, I know Twitter is still firing up. How do people keep abreast with what's going on?
Staying informed, I think, is very vital, especially in today's digital age. So I would actually implore everyone to follow social media outlets. I think now we have sister organizations or other groups we are liaising with, and they run under a Twitter account called Occupy Julobi. They push out updates and stuff on what we're doing and all that. But our main social media account is GHV is a country. Any informational stuff that people need to know, we push it through that side. We also go into kickstart Twitter spaces and stuff. I think Occupy Julobi already runs one on Thursdays.
I can speak a little bit to the Twitter spaces. So there is a space on Thursdays called, I think it's Occupy Julobi Radio, and it was quite informative. They brought professionals from different sectors, or I think the goal is to bring professionals from different sectors of governance in to explain how things are supposed to work in layman's terms to better help keep the average Ghanaian, who of course has access to these Twitter spaces, educated on what is supposed to happen. Because once you know what is supposed to happen, you are able to now gauge it to what may not be happening. So that is one of the ways that I know that people can keep abreast with what is going on the ground. So how can people, especially those of us in the diaspora, support what is going on?
You know, in the same way we, you know, I've said over and over again, and sometimes I think it might come across like I keep repeating the same points, but they're important. That's why I keep repeating them. Is that, you know, in the same way work has been done on Ghanaians to get us in this position, it's the same way that it's been done in the diaspora. You know, particularly as somebody who does live, you know, I spend majority of my time outside of Ghana. I've been able to resist because of other political things that I've been involved in, which clarified for me that actually this is not a group or a kind of activities I want to occupy myself with. However, a lot of people get caught up in that, you know, they get caught up in like, you know, the lust, the dream, the idea of home, but not the reality of home. And a lot of people forget that in one place and time, I'll give an example, the UK, you have a particular set of experiences. But when you move into a space like Ghana, it puts you in a different category. And it also means you have a particular set of experiences. And yours is not to, oh, if the particular set of experience now means I can do nonstop jams, oh, let me just jam. No, come on. Let's be serious here. It gives you an opportunity to do something better. You have a responsibility to do something about it. And, you know, I think people should look to how they can apply pressures wherever they are to give Ghanaians the opportunity to speak for themselves. I think, you know, money is a good way to also help. People are hungry right now. People, things are really tough for a lot of people. So whatever you can spare to help people, if we don't address the ways in which people are living now, we have no hope in getting them involved in our movement.
And I agree with that. You know, dollar and pounds to the rescue, not rescue, but to alleviate some things. Because it does add up. It does do something. And you're right. You could care less about the constitution when you don't have food on your table. So let's all do what we can to support the movement, even if we're not on the ground. So there are going to be those who can support on the ground, and there may be those of us who support with our resources towards the bigger goal. Any last comments, any last thoughts before I wrap up?
Sort of like answer how can people in the diaspora support what is going on? I think, yeah, for Ghanaians abroad, supporting discourse can take various forms, but the biggest to be financial contributions to what we are doing and to help sustain the movement. Also, the diaspora can help by raising international awareness on what is going on back in Ghana here through social media. Also, maybe they can engage their advocacy efforts by calling on their respective governments where they are. Sort of like have a significant impact on issues that we have in back home, or to support our protest goals.
Yeah. I don't want to be that person, but I just want to come back quickly on something that Benjamin said. I think it's okay to call for people outside of the country to support a cause. I think that that's incredibly important, especially if it's one for against oppression and for freedom and for justice. I think that's incredibly important. I think that we have to be really careful because calling on other governments outside of Ghana can be seen as people externally intervening in our country. And that is not something that I wish, you know, a lot of people would like or would like to go down. Like we are capable of determining the kind of country we want. We are capable of having a process, a political process that gives us the government, institution, etc., that we want. We don't need an intervention from an outside force and an outside country. I think it's really important to recognize that, because that could end up also being another form of oppression, one that we have historical experience of. So I just wanted to add that.
Thank you so much for that. Thank you so much. And on that note, I'd like to say again, thank you for making the time to be on the Ufahamu Africa podcast.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Ufahamu Africa. You can find more episodes, show notes, and transcripts on our website, ufahamuafrica.com. This podcast is produced and managed by Megan DeMint, with help from production assistants Chukwufunanya Ikechukwu, Alex Kozak, and Ami Tamaklo. We are generously supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and receive research assistance from Cornell University and the University of California, Riverside. Our music is courtesy of Kevin McLeod. Until next week, Safiri Salama.